This is Rose Iorio for the Underground Railroad Education Center at 194 Livingston Avenue, interviewing Catherine Sheehan on March 20th, 2026. So first off, Machine, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Kathy Sheehan, or Catherine Sheehan. I am the executive director of the Hart Clute Museum over in Troy, and I am also the Rensselaer County and Troy City Historian.
Thank you very much. And to start off, right, I'd like to ask you, why Troy, right? What about Troy had made it such a significant place kind of in New York at this time in this year, the 19th century?
Well, I think it's really interesting because Troy, I think geographically, I think that's what we have to look at Troy first, its location. And Troy is at the headwaters of the Hudson River, which is navigable all the way up to Troy. The tide actually changes there. And we are also the eastern terminus of the Erie and Champlain canals. And it was the waterways that were so responsible for the movement of freedom seekers coming up into New York State. And so Troy is already perched to be there. There also was, there was a lot of diversity in Troy very early on. Of course, the Dutch had settled there, but we had a lot of Germans that had come in who had worked there, were stationed there during the Revolution. I'm thinking the Battle of Bennington. It was, we're just Albany's neighbors to the north. We're only 8 miles northeast of the city of Albany, which of course is 100 years older than Troy. And so you kind of have this combination of people, like the Dutch, who, well, yes, they held slaves and stuff too, but they also were, they tended to kind of work with all sorts of different kinds of people, and we already had a substantial free Black community that was here in Troy early on. There was about 80 people or so that were considered free Blacks, according to the census. And I think they are some of the people who were impetuses to helping the freedom seekers as the city grew from a village in 1789. So I think those are some of the things that may have just meant Troy, but I think geographically that probably was one of the most important.
And on the topic of the free Black communities in Troy, mm-hmm. What were those communities? What was the bedrock of those communities? Who made those communities? What was it like for the everyday person in that kind of community?
Most of the free Black communities here, they were merchants. Samuel Baltimore, whose son Peter Baltimore is and his grandson, were integral partners in the Underground Railroad movement. Samuel ran an oyster shop at the head of Liberty Street. He came here after the American Revolution, coming down in from the Boston area. You had most of them either were working. A lot of people were working as stevedores on the docks in Troy. Again, Troy was really a shipping port. It's hard to think of an inland shipping port, but they really were. A lot of the produce and things that were coming from Western Massachusetts, Western Vermont, and Eastern Rensselaer County, which was really the fertile lands, all came into Troy before they either went down the river to New York City or eventually after 1824. Out the canal, out the Erie and Champlain canals, so they were involved in those early businesses.
And speaking of those early businesses and the free Black community in Troy, would it be accurate to say that this free Black community kind of gave rise to the later abolitionist movement in Troy?
I think that's a fair statement.
Yeah. And with that, do you think that the waterways, well, as they were significant in the development of Troy as a city, were significant in the abolitionist movement in the city as well?
Oh, absolutely. You had somebody like Pliny Moore, who ran a grain elevator, and right at the foot between Liberty and Washington Streets, and all the packet boats and canal boats that came up from New York City or came down, down south from the south from the canals into Troy. They were unloading all those grain. They also were bringing, particularly ones that were coming up from New York, bringing freedom seekers. Pliny Moore was secretary of the treasurer of the Eastern New York Anti-Slavery Society, as it turned out. And so he would help He would direct these people to go to Peter Baltimore's barbershop, which was only about four blocks away. Again, only one block in from the river. And it was there that Peter and William Rich, another person who came into town with Lafayette, actually, they would assist. They need to write letters and things. And then right next door from Peter's barbershop was the Athenaeum building. And the Athenaeum building held the offices of the Mental and Moral Improvement Society, that was run by the kind of the black free black community that was in Troy, and they were again helping to write letters. Also in that building was the offices of the Troy Female African Benevolent Society. They also were doing the gut work, clothes, food. Helping to, again, also write letters for the person, the freedom seeker to go to the next spot. What do you want to do? Are you wanting to continue on your way up to Canada? Or people felt safe in Troy and they would find them jobs in Troy, whether it was as domestic help for a lot of women who were doing that, or for men, a lot of them working on the docks, maybe with plenty more. You had all these warehouses that were just a block away. So a lot of people were working in those kind of, a lot of the black community that was coming in there were working on in those particular jobs.
You talk about these local organizations, mm-hmm. Detroit, these local free African American mm-hmm. organizations. How significant were those, not only in the development of the Underground Railroad, the abolitionist movement, but also just in the everyday life of the black community in Troy at this time?
Oh, I think they were very significant because they had, when you look through, and we have these records that we found in the Troy Savings Bank, it's what they deposited, which were thousands of dollars. So, you know, they were successful. They were there were people that are integrated through the churches, whether it was the, you know, what ultimately became Liberty Street Presbyterian Church, the AME Zion Church that was there. But they also, again, their connections with the white community is can't be dismissed by any means, because they were working with the lawyers and the bankers. I mean, the Troy Savings Bank is in that same building, and this Athenaeum building was just this, you know, it's just amazing things going on in here. You have this bank, and when you look at all those bank records, the Troy Female African Benevolent Society, the Mental and Moral Improvement Society, all had their bank accounts in this Troy Savings Bank. And later, as the different other immigrant groups that also settled in Troy, they also put their money in there. So these fraternal organizations. So the Troy Savings Bank really is this kind of catalyst. Now you have to think about the people who were in charge of that. We're all white men. But they were also going next door to Peter Baltimore's barbershop. You know, he was the one who's shaving them and taking care of them. I mean, a lot of businesses settled over the chair. Martin Ingram Townsend, who was a huge, he was this white lawyer, but he was helping. He was part of the abolitionist community. Good friend of Peter's, Peter Baltimore's, and you know, he is working through the community. So they had these connections between the white and the black community that was in Troy.
Tell me a bit more about Peter Baltimore. You know, his kind of story, his involvement with the abolitionist movement, all of that.
Yeah. So Peter's really is an interesting man. Again, he's born here. His father was from Boston, and he came into Troy as this oyster seller, as they said, on Liberty Street. Peter is born and starts what they call tonsorial parlor, because you had, where you're working on your shave, you know, as a barber. But barbers also did dental work too, by the way, and he has this small barbershop, and he gets very much involved in the Underground Railroad movement. As a young man, he meets Reverend Henry Highland Garnett, who is the black minister, who was brought in by Reverend Nathan Beeman, who was the minister of the First Presbyterian Church. He goes to New York City with him. As a matter of fact, we have this wonderful portrait of Peter Baltimore as a young man that was probably done in New York City when he was down with Henry Highland Garnett. And so he gets very much involved in this movement, and he's really integral. in April of 1860, when the rescue of Charles Now, just the rescue of Charles Now event is going on.
Please tell me more about that.
Okay, so Charles Nall is a freedom seeker who had escaped through the network. Is originally out in Averill Park in the town of Sand Lake, and he's working for a man by the name of Horace Averill. And I don't know how many years he was out there for a while, but at some point I think he realized that because of the Fugitive Slave Act laws, I think that he was not feeling safe. And as it turned out, even though he denied it, it was pretty much Horace Averill is probably the one who turned him in to bounty hunters. So he leaves Horace Averill, comes to Troy, and gets a job with Uri Gilbert. Now, Uri Gilbert was a mayor of Troy, and he also ran this coach manufacturer, a very large coach manufacturing firm. And so he basically was Mrs. Gilbert's coachman. One morning, he goes out to go get his bread, and he's captured under the Fugitive Slave Act by these bounty hunters. And he's literally, he's cuffed and ankle shackled at the ankles and the wrist, and they drag him up Second Street from Washington Street, and so about six blocks up to this district office where the circuit judge was coming in on the corner of State and First Street. Within 15 minutes, there were church bells ringing. A crowd of 1,000 people had gathered outside. They said they've captured Charles. And Peter Baltimore's barbershop was just around the corner from where this judge and where they had Peter holed up upstairs on the third floor of this building. And Peter couldn't get through the crowd. And so he goes out through the alley in the back of the barbershop. And who does he run into but Martin Townsend? And he says, Martin, he says, I have $200 in my hand. Martin says, I have $200 in my hand. We should be able to raise, because it was $650, I think, raise the other money with the people who are gathered here in the corner, and we can free Charles. So the two of them make their way up to the third floor where poor Charles now is desperate. At one point, he tries to jump out the window. And again, remember, he's shackled, and they drag him in. So at this point, now they've broken his wrist in that point, dragging him back into the building. And who is also in town visiting a cousin and probably helping people is Harriet Tubman. She works her way up into the third floor as well. And so, there's a couple kind of different accounts, a little bit, depending which paper you're reading. Is that when they came downstairs, they tried to get a writ of habeas corpus, Martin Townsend, and that didn't happen. And so, they're holding Peter up, or holding Charles up, I'm sorry, as an example. You're not going to get away. And they raised the bounty to, I think, like $1,000 or some crazy amount of money like that. So they're bringing him downstairs. They're going to be sending him back with these bounty hunters. And there's one point they said Harriet took her petticoat, threw it over one of the guards' heads. And they were able to, however it happened, they were able to release Charles. And this huge swarm of people, they start running down First Street with the area past where now was Russell Sage College. They get to the foot of Washington Street. Again, you're right near Pliny Moore's grain elevator. There's a ferry boat there. He's put on a ferry. And by now, people on the other side of the river, whatever Leet now is of West Troy at that time, and he's captured briefly again on the west side of the river, and they were able to, the other crowd is able to release him, and they get him on, coaches and things out to the Niskayuna area here, where then through safe houses, and then he's probably put on a canal boat. And, until a few years ago, we weren't ever really sure, did he actually ever get to Canada? But in fact, according to Frederick Douglass's paper, he did make it to St. Catharines, and there was a safe house that Harriet Tubman owned just over the border in St. Catharines. And he did stay there for a while until he came back. And then the citizens of Troy raised the rest of the money, and he stayed here in Troy until after the Civil War. And then he went back down to Virginia and never spoke a word about it again.
You mentioned the amount of characters in this story, the amount of people coming out to help Charles, the amount of people who are not named but are still helping him out in these crowds. What was this community? Was it a vibrant community in Troy? Was it close knit?
It was a vibrant community. I think that Troy's an interesting city because while it's kind of spread out north to south, it's the narrow focus, especially in the kind of downtown area, if you want to call it that today, is pretty narrow. I mean, you know, you're only about five blocks before you start hitting the hills of Troy. So, you know, it's pretty compact, and a lot of the areas where a lot of the black families lived tended to be around the churches, the A.M. Zion Church and the Liberty Street Church. So over on 5th Avenue and 7th Avenue and State Street, and then, on Liberty Street. But there were also other churches, and the other people that were involved in helping the freedom seekers as they were coming through and helping in this abolitionist movement were people like Father Havermans. Father Peter Havermans was a white priest. He came from Belgium, actually, and he came here in Troy in like the 1820s. And he basically built all the Catholic churches in Troy. So each of these immigrant groups had, there was an Irish church, there was a French church, there was a German church. And so he was integral to all those. But he was also very heavily involved in the abolitionist movement. He knew Peter Baltimore very well. He knew his father. He knew Samuel before he had died. And he knew Martin Townsend. And Peter himself is trying to build these communities. So he knew who to go for money and for, you know, buildings and to get people involved. Matter of fact, when during the draft riots in 1863, he literally put himself in front of the door of the Liberty Street Presbyterian Church and said, "You're going to have to go through me. If you're going to burn this church down, you're going to kill me first." he was that kind of a guy.
The draft riots are more commonly known for what occurred in New York City, but Troy had the second largest draft riot in the nation. Why do you think that's kind of gone under the radar historically for many people?
Yeah, it has. It has gone under the radar, and it's really kind of fascinating when you think about it. I mean, you have, you have this diverse. You have all these different immigrant groups, and I was trying to explain this to a fourth grader one day. You're like, we were talking about this, and I said, okay, you're putting yourself into what their situation was. We have a huge wave of potato famine Irish that came in after 1848, and they had largely settled into South Troy, working the ironworks and things. They came off the boat in New York, came up a boat and came in Troy. Never been anyplace else. They weren't invested in the Civil War, really. It all escalated, of course, after Lincoln enacted the draft. You could buy your way out of the draft with $300, as many wealthy men did. But, you know, that's like more than a year's salary for, you know, most workers there. So what they're seeing over this course of 3 years, and I think this is what I think is so fascinating about all of the story, and just kind of jump back a little bit, is you have these people who are all helping to free Charles. And there was Irish, there were Germans, there were, the black community, there was all this mix of people standing out there trying to free Charles. And then 3 short years later, probably 50% of those same people were wanting to, you know, destroy anything they had to do with the African-American community that was in Troy and anybody that was supporting, supporting this draft. And so they came up en masse, and it was predominantly Irish workers. They came up from South Troy, and they started destroying many of the buildings. They destroyed the Troy. The Troy Daily Times, which was an abolitionist friendly newspaper. They took the presses and threw them into the Hudson River. Martin Townsend, that white abolitionist lawyer, told him, they looted his house. They destroyed, tried to destroy it. They almost burned it down, but they didn't. But they looted his house. They went to the Liberty Street Presbyterian. The name of the official church is Liberty Street Presbyterian Church for Colored People. That was the name of the church. They were going to burn it. And that's where Father Havermans literally stood in front of it and said, "You're not going to do this." And now they've called out they've called out the militia from the Waterford Arsenal, which was just across the river. You have to disperse because you don't have to worry about dying on the battlefields. You're going to get shot now. And so he was able to disperse this. In the midst of all this, because this went on for two or three days, riots of the city. The black community escaped. Peter Baltimore and his family, with their son Garnet, Douglas Baltimore, they ended up over hiding out in Waterford. Many other went out to the country. They were trying to just escape. But there was this one man, his name was Charles Gidney. And Charles Gidney was here in Troy. He was over near it's called North 2nd Street. Now it's called 5th Avenue. And we have a letter in our collection that he describes what's going on to the mayor Van Alstyne. And it wasn't a letter saying, oh, my God, if somebody destroys my house, you're going to pay for it, which was a lot of the other letters that we have in the collection. This was, I'm a black man who can't go out and get their daily bread. I have Irish clubs, kids, little Irish kids with clubs in their hands saying, you know, to kill us. I don't say that, but I can't go out and my wife can't go out. I need you to forthwith please stop these riots so that we colored people can live in peace in Troy. And it's just such an amazing letter. And as it turns out, he also was this incredible mathematician who was working at the Troy University, which we didn't know that till about 10 years ago. We didn't even have the letter until about 15 years ago. We uncovered it.
When you tell a lot of these stories, there's actually a high degree of movement that I think would surprise many people. Mm-hmm. Many people think that people, you know, in the 19th century didn't move around, especially the free black community may not have been moving around for a whole host of reasons. But that doesn't seem to be very true in these stories. Why? Do you think that's a misconception historically?
I think it's just a misconception historically. We think people didn't move, but and certainly in the Troy, again, location, location, location. You know, you have the ability to move around because of the river. You also within houses, people move like every year. You know, sometimes they would have a house here, they would go over here. We have a lot of you can call them flats where we have you know, three-story family houses. You have a lot of black community that was in Troy, if they were working as coachmen and things like that, sometimes even had apartments over the carriage house. That would be their space. But other people had, you know, different flats. So they did move around. It was like every year there was this like May Day moving day. Everybody moved. And sometimes it was always probably for a better situation. You know, maybe as you've settled in and made a little bit more money, you can get a little bit more space. You get a little bit better housing. You get, you know, you don't need to have a place on the alley side up over a carriage house. Now you've moved up and you know, things like that. So people did move around a lot. Yeah.
And on the topic of geography, mm-hmm. You know, when we think of these stories of abolition or of enslavement, we think sometimes in these kind of grandiose national pictures. Or maybe we settle on, you know, this kind of geographic divide between North and South. What makes upstate New York specifically and studying our local area important in understanding this larger national question and history?
Well, I think the Erie Canal is the catalyst because you did have access to the point where you could get to Canada because so many people wanted to get there until they realized, like coming to Troy, they went, wait, we feel safe here. There's a good community that's going to help. Who's got our back? And I think that was for the most part pretty true. And so that I think we're just one example. And there's other, I think Utica, Syracuse, you know, certainly Albany here. And they worked together. I mean, a lot of abolitionists that were in Albany were also, you know, back and forth with Troy and, you know, the vigilant committees and you know, speakers that were coming in and people that were supporting that were supporting over here as well on the west side of the river as much as on the east side. So I think it's, and there are newspapers and communication was better than what you would think it would be. So I know we think of everything so instantaneous, but the fact that, you know, you had, Troy had something like, at its height, something like 15 newspapers in the mid-19th century. I'm sure Albany even had more. You know, and there was, you had the Clarion, Henry Highland Garnett's paper. You had the oh gosh, I can't think what the other papers were. The other black newspapers that were out at the same time. So, there's a lot of information out there, and it's out there. And that was the other thing is, I think when people coming in and saying, "Wow, you're like talking," they're reporting about, you know, William Rich and the vigilant committees that are in the Troy Daily Times. They're in the regular newspaper that everybody could read, and you could see how many people were here, and you could see that Frederick Douglass was coming to Troy, and this was a big deal. People came from all over to hear him, and ads in the paper from like the young woman by the name of Peggy Williams, who had a boarding house a block away from the Liberty Street Presbyterian Church, advertising in the papers, "You're coming up to Troy. You're going to go up to Saratoga. You know, stay here at my boarding house." It's very above ground and very productive.
And do you think part of that productivity was kind of the fact that the black community in Troy was flourishing?
Yes, absolutely.
And in what way were they flourishing relative to other similar communities throughout the country?
Well, there's black doctors, there's black businesses. You have, Peter, they weren't the only barbershop around. There were several. They had bakeries. Think of all the things, you know, general things you need. There were stores or businesses. There was a towboat company that was actually came out of Albany, but there were Troy connections with that. Tugboat company, Schuyler's. That was a black man. So there was, you know, their regular, you know, businesses and things are going on. So like everybody else. Yeah.
And as a final topic of conversation, what are some of the, in all your years of working with history, what are some of the myths that you found, whether in regards to local history, African-American history, the Underground Railroad, abolition, whatever it may be, what are the kind of myths that you've had to encounter and research into?
That everybody had tunnels. Anybody that was anywhere near a body of water, including waterfalls, said that their house was on the Underground Railroad, even though the houses were built after the Civil War was finished, just some of them. So, you know, it's just like if you had a tunnel there, it was going to be perpetually underwater. That's always one of them. I've had a few people say, "Well, how come there's no more paper evidence about where all the safe houses were?" And I was like, "Well, that was part of the, you know, especially after the once." If you were caught aiding and abetting, once the Fugitive Slave Acts were really, then you really did have to be kind of underground. So you didn't have a lot of, they didn't survive those letters that were written by the women in the Troy Female African Benevolent Society to send out. But there are a couple that do exist. We know there was a path going out through Hoosick Street up in Mapletown area and then over to Vermont. That was one other avenue out. There actually is a couple of letters that are along there coming back into Troy. So some of those things just don't physically survive.
Yeah, and despite the fact they don't physically survive, there's sometimes circumstantial evidence of their existence, yeah. Right? Like there's not a lot of direct evidence of women working in these movements, but they did, correct?
Yeah, but we actually, now we have evidence of that. Like the Troy Female African Benevolent Society, we know their names because they had to be signatories on the account book that the Troy Savings Bank had. So we know about Phoebe Van Rensselaer, we know about Peggy Williams, we know about Mary Lane Baltimore. They had their signatures in the bank underneath the heading of the Troy Female African Benevolent Society. So that's very exciting. This kind of new research in the last 10 years as these archives are uncovering for other reasons why we collect it. And then you find out that you have this wonderful involvement.
And do you think it's important to mention the involvement of women within this movement?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, the women always do all the work. Just kidding. But they do a lot of that work. And they did do a lot of that work. So it's great. It's great for them to be able to get their just due and to be, you know, to understand how important they were. And they raised, there's something over $30,000. That's a lot of money in 1830 to have raised, to be able to, and that is the nuts and bolts of helping freedom seekers. you know, think about it. You're coming up from, you know, Georgia, Mississippi, you know, South Carolina, and the temperature up here is very different than what you have down there. They were not, they needed clothing. You need boots. You need, you know, warm things and food and shelter. So those basic needs were met by these women.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
When I think of this, I think of the fact that all of this movement was enabled not by the few notable people, but by everyday people
right. Who
are working together. And I thank you so much because your interview has really shown some light on that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for asking me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks.